Hey, everybody, this is Richard Deitch, and welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. My producer, as always, is Lou Pellegrino. The guest this week is Louis Riddick, the fine ESPN NFL analyst. We have a really in-depth and interesting conversation on a lot of NFL topics, including Louis's interest in Monday Night Football. I think you're really going to enjoy this. He is always an interesting guy to talk to. Louis Riddick coming up on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. All right, and as we said at the top, we bring in Louis Riddick, an NFL analyst for ESPN. You see him, of course, on multiple programs, including SportsCenter, NFL Live. He is one of the principals in the network's NFL draft coverage, and as I've written many times, I think arguably their best football hire in the last 10 years. Louis Riddick, welcome back to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Richard, thanks for having me, man. You know, I really enjoyed it the first time. I think some people who told me they listened to it really enjoyed it, so let's see if we can do them a good one this time, too.
Appreciate that. Louis, what, in your opinion, separates a good NFL broadcaster from an average one?
The work that they put in, it kind of comes out once you start talking about the game. You can tell who's put in the work and who hasn't, because what winds up happening is they go much deeper than what people consider to be surface information, the kind of stuff that you could pull up on ESPN.com or NFL.com and find out for yourself. People want to be educated. People want to be told stuff that they don't really know. And they don't want to always be told by broadcasters, especially broadcasters who have a background like mine, who have played the game at some level, on the NFL level, that is. You know, they don't want to be told about stories all the time about when they played. They want to be told about things that are current. They want to be told about things that are happening right now. They want to be told about things that they can't find on the internet. And when you hear people going next level with it, as far as analysts are concerned, that's when you know that they're special, that they're the kind of people who are trying to take this profession to the next level. And I think, quite honestly, NFL broadcasting in general, can get very lazy. It can become very surface. It can become very robotic, to the point where you just start tuning out, and you almost want to watch games the same way you watch a game at a bar. You don't need the volume on. Just show me the game. I don't really need to hear all the nonsense that's being said, because I could find that out anywhere. Inform me, educate me. And if you can do that, I think that is what can start to separate the average from the good, from the great broadcasters.
Louis, as specific as you can, how have you gotten better in the field? What have you done specifically to improve since you arrived at ESPN as someone who did not have a lot of broadcasting experience?
I think I've tried to really become more concise with what I want to say and answer the questions and get to the points quickly and then broaden from there and not have so much lead up to what ultimately is going to be my point, which can cause you to kind of run on and on and on with your answers. And at that point in time, you know, I guess maybe you will start to have some people tune out and not really, or they'll miss the point of exactly what it is that you want to say. So I think that's the number one thing when I'm on air that I try to get to right off the bat. People like information quickly and concisely. I mean, we live in that kind of world. But I think also at the same time, I mean, really one of my strengths is being able to get into and dive into deep, complicated subjects concerning the game of football, and at the same time keeping it interesting and having people still be interested in what I'm saying and not going, okay, look, I got the point. So just being quicker, Richard, with the things that I want to say, and making sure that the questions are and the topics that we're talking about are answered right from the jump.
Louis, you played in the NFL. You were obviously a renowned college football player and high school football player. And, you know, there are things that athletes do in terms of to get better. One of the things, obviously, is they watch a lot of film of themselves, look for opponents' tendencies, et cetera. Is there anything you do, either film-wise or audio-wise, regarding your own broadcasting work to try to get better? Do you – you've been on the air for a lot of hours now, so I imagine you couldn't rewatch everything you've done. But do you rewatch or re-listen to things that you've said on air to try to get better, to try to pick things up?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I try to DVR as much stuff as I possibly can. And when I get home from having been on air, it's tough sometimes. It's actually pretty tough sitting there critiquing yourself, because there's many times where I sit there and cringe and go, oh, I could have said that better. Why is my face looking like that? Why am I holding my hands like that? Why am I tilting my head like that? I'm constantly searching for a better way as far as how I present myself, how I dress, how I answer questions, how I enunciate words, how I string my thoughts together. Yeah, that's a never-ending process. That goes back to, you know, my training as an athlete, the kinds of coaches that I played for where nothing was ever good enough. And it's not something that's unhealthy. I mean, this is a healthy pursuit of excellence, pursuit of trying to be perfect as far as what we're doing. Because, like I said, you know, broadcasting is like any other job as far as being a professional. Why wouldn't you always be trying to get better? Why wouldn't you always be trying to critique yourself down to the most minute detail and see if you can have one of those performances on camera where you go, that was perfect. That's exactly how I want it to be every time. Because in this business, it's hard to be judged. It really is. It's such a subjective type of thing. In football, there's you win and you lose. You can look on, you know, statspass.com, and you can look up your stats and figure out how you're comparing to and stacking up to the next guy. You know, it's easy in football. In football, you know, there's. I think that's why guys, high-end achievers in football and in any sport, really like it, because they want to be judged. In broadcasting, it's much different. It's hard to really get a feel for when you get off camera. Have I done good enough? Was that good enough? Was that a championship level performance? And that's why I always watch it back. That's why I always look at it. And still not satisfied. Not even close.
Lewis, it's interesting. You mentioned something there that's not often talked about, especially among men, I think. And that's sort of you looked at how you were dressed. How important for you is the aesthetics part of broadcasting? To me, obviously, when I'm watching a broadcaster, I want content, and that's how I judge my broadcasters on. I understand, though, it's a visual profession, and there are producers who are interested, obviously, in the visuals. So when you are thinking about I'm not sure I've asked a lot of male broadcasters or women broadcasters this, but when you're thinking about presentation in terms of clothes, in terms of dressing, how deep or how detailed do you get into that in terms of just part of the overall package of being on air?
Oh, it's a big part for me. I mean, let's face it, we live in that kind of world now where everyone is always judging you by your appearance first. People are attracted to you and want to listen to you and want to hear what you have to say based upon how you look. Often, they just are, whether we like it or not. And then you will keep their attention based upon what you say, how you treat them. I don't think that's any different in TV at all. So when I'm putting together the kinds of things that I want to wear, I'm very, very cognizant of how it will look on TV, how it matches. Everything down from the type of tie I wear to the type of watch that I wear to the type of shoes that I wear, how my stuff is fitting. And I look for feedback on that. And people, quite honestly, Richard, have been very positive with me on social media about my clothing choices and how I try to present myself that way. And I think that holds their attention right from the get-go. And then they have really liked so far, and I've gotten a lot of feedback so far that's been very positive about the content that I deliver. So I don't think that's something that's just specific to women. I think that's something that all of us who are in the media should be aware of, that, hey, you know, how we present ourselves, the first impression that we give people is important. I mean, it's a race out there for viewers. It's a race out there for ratings and whatever you, and this is a part of it. You know, you don't want people don't want to, like, come on, turn on their TV and look at people who don't seem to be trying to put their best foot forward in every way, shape, or form. And I know that's my approach to it, and it'll always be that way.
Yeah, it's the specific part to women is that too often it's the aesthetics that are judged first, foremost, sure, and last, where it's different for men. But I appreciate that answer. One of the things that I've always appreciated about you is your candidness. My colleague Peter King referenced something you said not too long ago when the Browns GM John Dorsey was talking about how Cleveland's open for business. They have multiple high draft picks in the coming up. You said at some point you need to use your picks and select develop players to win games. So tired of hearing this "we are open for business" off-season pre-draft BS. It's as if, Lewis, you personally take in your opinion, poor management decisions personally. Am I correct about that? A lot of times with you, I feel like it's not just you're saying this as a broadcaster. It's you're saying it because you are personally affronted as a football person.
There's no doubt about that. And I think, you know, see, sometimes people accuse me of being cryptic with the kinds of things that I say. But I think if they listen to me closely, they know exactly who and what I'm talking about, and I'm not afraid to say who and what I'm talking about if they want to ask me about it. It's like this. So much of the off season in particular, Richard, becomes about the art of the deal, about how many ones could I get for this guy, how many twos does this team have, how many trades has this team made, what position can this team get into. It's always about the mechanics involved around draft capital and how much salary cap money the teams have, or how many different ways in which they can improve the team. It's always about that, always about the, you know, just really the administrative part of building a team, and not so much about, okay, well, what happens after you actually select a player, and then what are you doing for that player and helping that player to achieve everything that you want that player to achieve, and thus as a team you achieve everything that you want to achieve. I think that's where I start to get annoyed, is when the conversation doesn't start focusing on that, on the actual game itself and what football teams are doing and what GMs are doing, what coaches are doing, what support staff is doing, in order to see it through at the very end, to where now all those players that you were talking about that you were able to acquire with all those trades and all those draft picks that you guys were getting all hyped up about that you have, that's the part where I want the focus to become. That's really the part where everything breaks down in the NFL. And I know this, and the reason why I get so passionate about it is because, look, in my own experience as a player, my career turned because I went from one team to another where the coaching and the attention to detail and the demands that were placed on me went from kindergarten level to, like, MIT level overnight. When I left the Atlanta Falcons in 1992, went to the Cleveland Browns in 1993, all of a sudden, my position coach was Nick Saban. My head coach was Bill Belichick. And the kinds of demands that they were putting on me and the kind of things that they asked of me from a preparation standpoint, from an execution standpoint, from an accountability standpoint, and then doing it the next day and the next day and the next day, that took my career from being one where who knows what it would have been to where I wound up thinking, you know, looking back on it now, I go, I had a pretty good career. I had a pretty good career, and I owe a lot of it to them. So when you hear me passionately start talking about these things, especially these off-season things at this time of year, it's almost like, look, don't tell me about how you're open for business and that you know you're willing to move down and to acquire more picks and how you're such a great deal maker and all this stuff. Just talk to me about the players that you have drafted, and then what you did to help them win, and what you did to help your franchise become relevant. Just tell me about that stuff. Tell me what you're doing in that regard, because that's the kind of thing that I think right now I don't think people pay enough attention to. People want at this time of year to really start, you know, they want to talk about how many draft picks people have. They want to talk about how good this prospect is relative to that prospect and how this player should be a Pro Bowler and how this player would be a backup. But they don't understand why players really become Pro Bowlers and why players become backups, why some teams are successful, why some teams aren't successful, because that's really, you know, that's the gray area. That's stuff that they aren't really privy to. That's the stuff that they don't really know that goes on behind the scenes. But I know. I lived it. And that's where I'm always trying to go. I'm always trying to take people behind that curtain to try and give people some insight into that process. And I think, again, I mean, if you go back to your original question about what makes a good broadcaster, these are the kind of things I like talking about. And if you watch me, I talk about these kind of things. I can talk about, you know, trading up and down the draft and how many draft picks people have, but I can read that online. Let's talk about some things that really matter in the NFL, that really separate the good teams from the great teams, the good teams from the bad teams.
Lewis, you mentioned Nick Saban and he being your position coach. So since you brought it up, I do want to ask you, because it's obviously one of the great coaches of the modern era in college football. Can you give the people who are listening just a sense of what separates someone like Nick Saban as a position coach from another position coach? Obviously, there's something people like Nick Saban and Bill Belichick do that other coaches don't do. So specific to Saban, in your time with him, what is different about him as a coach versus someone else?
Well, obviously, okay, first and foremost, obviously, he's an expert at the game of football, all right? He understands all the positions, how they all work together. He could coach any position if it was necessary, all right? So, and Bill Belichick the same. So if one day the quarterback coach or the tight end coach or the inside linebacker coach for some reason couldn't coach for a couple weeks, a couple games, these guys could step right in and coach that position equal to or better than their position coach whose area of expertise that was. So they have an overall working knowledge of the game that is freaking incredible. And I've seen it. I've seen Bill do it. I know Nick can do it. Now, specific to what Nick taught me as a defensive back in particular, which is really his area of expertise, look, it's the nuance of the game from what you need to know pre-snap as far as what your opponent's going to do based on their alignment and their personnel. He gives those tips to you in a way that makes sense to you, in a way that you can apply functionally once the ball is snapped. So the mental preparation that these guys, and this goes for Bill too, when I'm talking about this stuff, they both do this. They give you the information in a way that you can use and apply once the game starts going better than anyone I've ever been around. Post-snap, what happens is they drill you and hold you at such a high level of accountability for doing it fundamentally the way that they teach it to you. And they rep those kinds of things which are over and over to the point where it becomes just a part of your muscle memory. And you wind up playing the game fundamentally at a level that is even higher than what you thought you could ever play it at. And the reason why you do it is because they won't let you not do it. Because if you don't do it the way that they want you to, you won't play for them. In college, you'll sit the bench, you'll wind up transferring, you'll wind up having your ego destroyed because you thought you were some hotshot five-star, but he won't put you on the field because you won't do it the way you want. And at the pro level, they'll cut you. They'll just send you down the road and say, look, you're just not my kind of guy because this is what I demand. The accountability is really the thing that really separates them, I believe, from other coaches that I've been around. Some coaches talk about accountability. Some coaches talk about consistency. Some coaches talk about having that kind of resolve to not take it personal, the kind of things that they say to you, the kind of demands that they put on you, but understand that they're trying to just make you better. Some coaches talk about that. Some coaches actually execute on it. These guys execute on it at the highest level. And I'll tell you this. There was a point in time when I played for the Browns. I think it was a season of 1994. It was my second season there, where I thought Nick Saban was going to break me. I thought I was going to actually go, you know what? I don't want to play football anymore. It's one of those things where I used to sit up at night and worry and not sleep because of mistakes I made in a practice the prior day, and I didn't want to hear the wrath that was going to come down on me the next day of practice in the film room around my peers, where I'd have to like look at other players looking at me and laughing at me. Like, look, Bill really got in your ass today. Nick really ripped your ass today. And he did it to everybody. But it was that kind of pressure that it's hard, man. It's not for everybody. But I did persevere. I did push through it. And I earned his respect. I earned Bill's respect. And once you do that, it opens up even a bigger door, like a whole new world as far as information, because you start hearing the information even differently, even more different. And these guys are special. I've been around a ton of coaches, a ton of players. They're special. They're different. But the number one thing is, it's the accountability. And it's the highest level, man. They will not accept mediocrity. They will not accept average. They want consistency at the highest level. And if you can't give it to them, they'll move on from you. And I love that. I actually love that. And I'm someone who gets accused many times of putting high expectations and holding other people to high standards and going. And I've been told many times, man, you need to let up. You need to ease up. You know, not everybody wants to achieve at that level. Well, those guys, their message resonated with me at that time in 93, 94. And it's quite honestly, I know it may sound, people may be listening to this podcast and thinking, oh, that just sounds like hyperbole. But no, it's how I approach this job now. And anybody up at ESPN will tell you the same thing. When I'm up there, very rarely do you see me on that campus just messing around, not doing something. I always have my laptop out. Two or three of them at a time, one that's on film, one that has up statistics that I'm looking for, one that has some research that I got from somewhere else. I'm always on the grind trying to take what I do to to the next level. That's just the only way I know, and it's the only way I'll ever be.
Lewis, are you still in touch with Nick Saban?
Yeah, I still talk to him. I talked to him, as a matter of fact. Last I talked to him was about a month and a half ago, as they were getting ready. They were just getting ready to start preparing for the national championship game.
The detail of those guys, that's really fascinating. I want to ask you about this interesting dynamic of you being a broadcaster yet interviewing for general manager positions. You were one of the four candidates to interview for the Giants GM job a couple months ago. And I'm curious as to how does that work internally for you, in terms of do you inform your bosses that this is coming down the pike, or do you consider the potential opportunity to work in the league separate from your broadcasting, and you pursue that sort of individually, and if you end up going back to broadcasting, you're doing your broadcasting? I'm just curious, how does it work in terms of navigating that?
Well, I always try to be upfront about any opportunity that comes down the pike and let ESPN know that this is a possibility, that the team has expressed interest and that maybe I'm going to interview with them. And then ultimately, when I do interview with them, letting them know that I'm interviewing with them. And it's something where we've always been open and upfront from the very get-go when I was hired there, that I would not use my platform at ESPN to try and solicit a job, and I don't. And I don't give a damn what anybody says. You could never accuse me of trying to dance around subjects or protect certain organizations or coaches in such a way that you get the impression that I'm always angling for a job, or that I'm just using this as a stepping stone to get somewhere. You can tell the people who do that, and I'm not one of them. So, and I told them, I will work at ESPN as long as they'll have me. But if an opportunity comes up to get back to the NFL in a decision-making capacity at the highest level, meaning I'm running the organization or running the football operation, then it would be something I would hope they would not be offended that I would look into. And they have always said from the very beginning, we would not hold you back. We would, we would support you in that kind of endeavor. Obviously, we want you to stay here in broadcasting because we think you have a great career here. But we understand how this works. We understand how it goes. And in the end, it's good for them, too. It's good for them, too, to have the people who are on air, who are quote-unquote experts, to be the kind of people that the professional sports leagues consider worthy of interviewing. I mean, it helps them, too. It helps their exposure, too. It helps their credibility as well. Now, there are times where certain teams operate with a higher level of secrecy than others, and they would like for you to keep things quiet. So it's not, going across the ticker on the bottom of the screen that such and such a team is considering such and such a candidate for a role. But, I mean, the teams also know that, look, when you're in the media like myself, I mean, it's one of those things where you have an obligation as well to your, to the people who are employing you, to kind of let them know what's going on with you. It's hard to work or to kind of exist in two totally separate worlds without them kind of blending together and without needing to be honest with one another. So I've been able to navigate that pretty well. It's something that still is a goal of mine, to run a franchise, not any franchise, but run, some of the more, I want to say that the franchises that kind of really have shown a history of doing it the way that it's supposed to be done and giving you the support that they're supposed to give you from an administrative standpoint. And if those opportunities come up in the future, I'll explore them. But it's not something that I'm out there politicking for. It's not something that everything that I say at ESPN, it has some kind of hidden agenda to where I'm trying to get someone's attention. That's not what I'm doing. That's not how I've ever done it. But they're well aware of the fact that I would love to build a professional football team from the ground up. And if it happens, it happens. If it doesn't, and there's some pretty big goals that I'm after as far as broadcasting too. So ESPN is going to do nothing but win as far as how I'm trying to approach this.
Lewis, I want to bring something up regarding this, because it's very interesting to me, and you've already dealt with it a little bit. When you are in your position, someone who's works in the media and interviews for these kind of very, very high-profile jobs, not only ESPN but other media are going to write about that. I remember we interacted when after you went on social media to emphatically deny an NFL report that you were contacted by the Kansas City Chiefs for their GM job. So how have you – maybe not – let me sort of – how should I phrase this? Do you have a certain approach as to being in the news? Do you understand that if you're interviewing, let's say, for the Giants job, there are going to be people in NFL circles who want to ask you about that? And then you have to navigate, well, do I let my employer know this so that they can report the news? Or do I answer questions of other reporters who may be competitors of ESPN? To me, that's a very little tricky world to navigate between, one, confirming or telling people what you're doing, and then two, do you have some kind of obligation because ESPN is paying you to report this news about yourself on ESPN?
Sure. No, I will always, from my perspective, the first people I will inform directly and the first people that would ever get a quote from me or a confirmation from me will be the people at ESPN, because I do owe that to them, because they are my employer, and because I do understand this is a highly competitive business, and I would never give a story or give a quote or a confirmation to a competitor. That's just not how I do things. And quite honestly, I was one of those guys who, when I was in front of office work, was not one of those people who took very kindly to people blowing up my phone, trying to get confirmation and trying to get scoops. And it's kind of ironic that now I'm in this business. But that kind of thing always pissed me off, to be honest with you. I wasn't into the whole scoop business. I didn't like it. I didn't like being called and being used and bled for information like that. I didn't like that. So when it comes to me in particular right now, if there's something to say, if there's something I have to say or something I want to confirm, it's going to be if there's a message I want to get out there, it'll be through ESPN. It won't be through anybody else. And that's why when the whole Kansas City Chiefs thing came up about that they had contacted me and they were in the process of setting up an interview. But that was just bullshit. That wasn't the truth. It wasn't the truth. And that's why I emphatically said that it wasn't the truth. Because if there something had been set up, the first news outlet that would have got a direct quote from me or direct confirmation from me, obviously would have been the one I work for. And it would have come from them. So look, the information, I can't control what on the team side of things, but teams have people, NFL teams have people who work in those buildings who have relationships with reporters too. And information travels through NFL buildings or NBA buildings or MLB buildings pretty quickly once a name starts circulating about a potential hire. And they can't control what all those people say and what all those people talk about. But I can tell you this, having worked on that side of it, people have big mouths. People want to talk. And there are reporters who hang around those buildings on a daily basis. Some of them, you know, local. There's national people who are in those buildings on a daily basis who have contacts. And it's not out of the realm of possibility that someone in the building tells someone from a rival outlet, hey, so-and-so's name was brought up today as a candidate that we may bring in here for, you know, a significant position. Next thing you know, that report, boom, hits the wire as, you know, sources say that so-and-so is going to be interviewing for this job. And it has nothing to do with, since we're asking me, it has nothing to do with me. It has nothing to do with me talking to those people. It has to do with that's how information kind of travels. That's how rumors get out there. That's how things start going across other rival networks' bottom line. And it's not because I've said something. It's because people can't seem to not keep their mouths shut in this business. That's why, you understand, this is how information rolls. This is how the whole concept of sources has come about. Sources are people who don't want to keep things to themselves and who have relationships with other people and are willing to give them that information for some kind of favor in return. That's how the business works. But when people start saying things about me and they say, well, their sources say that he's coming in here for this interview or whatever, that's why I went on Twitter with that very snarky snapback type of comment. If you really want it from the real source, ask me. Because I can tell you this, they hadn't set up anything. And if I was going to say anything about something that was set up, I wouldn't have told you. I would have told someone at my own network, and they would have put it out, and they could directly say it was from me. And anyone who would ask me, I would tell them, yeah, I'm the one who said it. So that's how it's difficult, but at the same time, Richard, it's really not.
Well, it's interesting because I think the reason why that was a very successful thing that you did is we don't often see the subject be that emphatic and that public about, one, the denial, right, and two, if you have any questions, just ask me. So a lot of times subjects will, you know, they may not confirm or deny. They'll sort of just go, they'll go sort of turtling and not respond at all.
Right.
You put yourself out there. So to me, if I'm an independent observer, my thought is, this guy, one, he's saying this, two, he's not hiding, and three, he's owning it. So he's either massively lying to all of us, or he's telling the truth.
Yeah.
And I thought that was whether you intentionally did that or not, I thought that was one of the best ways I've ever seen of somebody coming out and stopping the information cycle about them.
Yeah, that was a very organic response on my part. It wasn't calculated. It wasn't. I didn't really think about it, you know, that way. It just kind of pissed me off that it was out there, and that it was being reported out like it was 100% surefire news. And I'm going, well, here's the funny thing, though. No one's asked me about if I'm gone or not, and if anybody has paid close attention, you know, to how I kind of try and do things, I'll tell you. Yes, I'm going. No, I'm not going. Yes, I interviewed. No, I didn't. You know, how I feel about things is pretty, it's pretty straightforward. I don't really try to dance around a whole lot of things. And you're right. I will admit this. There is that kind of personal component to it of this. Look, when a rival network says that like that, and they makes it seem like, you know, they got some information about me that they're going with 100% that my own network hasn't even put out. Yeah, there was a little bit of pride to it. There was a little bit of, you know, of a personal nature to it. Like, hey, look, don't report that stuff and you've never talked to me, because I'm really the one who knows. And if you think, do you really not think that if I was going, that, you know, I would try and make sure that my network was the one who got a direct quote from me? You think I wouldn't do that? So yeah, I really didn't look at it as being a big risk or a big gamble at all. It's just something that organically just kind of happened with me. And I guess people, you know, like yourself, really did respect that I handled it that way.
All right, guys, before we move on, let me tell you about Mattress Firm. Everyone knows how important stretching is before a sporting event. So does Mattress Firm, except it's your dollar. Your budget stretches further when you're shopping at America's Neighborhood Mattress Store. It's a true home run. They're the head coaches when it comes to mattress expertise, but know this, they are more than mattress experts. They have a game plan that helps you transform your mattress into a bed. From adjustable bases and sheets to headboards and bedroom decor, they have you literally and figuratively covered up like your favorite cornerback. Go to mattressfirm.com/podcast to see what deals are happening. They even offer you a 120-night sleep trial to ensure perfection and a 120-night low price guarantee, so you know you've paid the perfect price. Talk about a 1-2 punch. Score big with a perfect bed. Head to mattressfirm.com/podcast. to get the play-by-play on how you can monumentally improve your sleep today, tonight, and tomorrow. One last one on sort of the opportunities of being a general manager. If something came up mid-season where there was an opening in one of these teams that fit your criteria about doing things right historically, would you think about the prospect of leaving ESPN, quote unquote, mid NFL season for that kind of position? Or once the NFL season begins, do you commit yourself to broadcasting and seeing it through to the end of the year?
Yeah, you know, I really can't say how I would handle that situation, because I guess everyone would be different. If it was such a unique situation where you felt as though this is a once in a lifetime opportunity, I think I'd want to talk it through with the people at ESPN and see if it was something that would be a possibility. I mean, I can't imagine, you know, I'm sure there's a scenario like that could come up, but ideally would I like to obviously finish out a season and not leave somebody hanging and giving someone, you know, your full season's worth of commitment. Sure. I mean, that's how I am. I don't look at this as being a day-to-day type of job or being something where, you know, a decision that I would make for myself could not have some negative consequences for, you know, the place that I work with, and I'd never want to leave them in that position. But I think because these jobs are so unique, and because the landscape is always changing in the NFL, and owners are very fickle, and they can be very emotional, and they can change things on the fly at a moment's notice. I think you have to be adaptable too. So it's not something I ideally want to do, Richard, not at all, and it's not something I would take very lightly. But I guess anything's a possibility.
Lewis, I want to ask you, I want to move to a couple of things maybe you haven't talked about a lot, but I would be interested in how you approach it. You have a lot of colleagues at ESPN who will wade into social issues and politics on their social media feeds like Twitter. How do you approach discussing social issues or politics on social media if you do discuss it at all?
I don't discuss it at all. I mean, we all have feelings about it. We all know what's going on in the world. We all know some of the nonsense that's going on, and we all have different opinions about it. But I'm paid to talk about sports. Sometimes sports does intersect with politics in a way that we do discuss. But as far as what my personal feelings are for certain government officials or certain people who are involved in politics and make a career in politics, I don't get into it. It's a very slippery slope. It's something where, quite honestly, I'm not as well versed as others are, and I'm not willing to speak and go on the record about, because I just don't know. I just don't know if I'm prepared to really represent myself professionally in a manner that I think is appropriate. And two, I just don't see that as being my role. So I don't discuss those kinds of things very much with people at ESPN. That's kind of stuff that I would discuss in my private life. And I definitely have some strong feelings about, but that's not an area I get into, nor will you ever really see me get into.
Couple things on Monday Night Football. First off, have you been approached at all about replacing John Gruden in the booth?
Yeah, this is something that I definitely has been a goal of mine, and ESPN is very, 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 very well aware that I am very much so interested in. It's the pinnacle of broadcasting, as far as I'm concerned. It's the most iconic position in broadcasting, period, to be involved with Monday Night Football, either as a play-by-play or as an analyst. And it's something that I'm hoping I can achieve. No question about that.
Can I ask, when you have let whether it's Seth Markman or Stephanie Drewley or any ESPN executive know of your interest in being part of Monday Night Football, what has been their response to that?
It's been very favorable, very favorable. They are well aware of it. I think you saw me take kind of a, you saw what my level of interest is as far as being a part of live games, live broadcasts with my involvement with the Pro Bowl this year, with my on the field analysis, which quite honestly only scratches the surface of what I think I'm capable of doing with that kind of platform. I have so many things I can add to a live broadcast that make your head spin, and I am fired up about the whole possibility of being possibly involved with the brand of Monday Night Football in any way, shape, or form. And I think the next couple of weeks and months, as ESPN figures out where they want to go with that, are going to be awful, awful exciting for me personally.
Let me ask you a question, Lewis. And this, I don't ask this pejoratively. I really asked it objectively. Could you, without having broadcasting experience doing NFL games as an analyst, do you believe you could walk to a national broadcast and sit beside Sean McDonough and do that job, whether it was you two solo or whether there was a third analyst? Because it is no one would argue that you know football. You clearly do. But that is a unique skill set, just in terms of how do you analyze something in this short amount of time, the mechanics of doing the telestrator and stuff like that. Do you think you could, with a couple practice games, walk in September and do that?
I don't think there's any question or any doubt in my mind. I have no reservations about my ability to be able to call a game live and do it quickly and concisely, get in and get out, to not step on the toes of the person who is handling the play-by-play, to work a telestrator, to work an all 22 film video that you would have at your disposal in the booth, give quick anecdotes about information that would keep people informed, understand the rules of the game, understand the flow of the game. I mean, look, that stuff, that's me. That's who I am. That's what I believe I do the very best. You just haven't seen that because I haven't had that platform yet. But to be able to do that, I have no doubts in my mind whatsoever, Richard, and I don't say this to sound like someone who's trying to be a salesman of myself, but look, everything that I set out to do in this business, but most of the time people have thought, well, you know, there's no way he could do that. There's no way he can do that. Well, why is that? Because I wasn't a Pro Bowler? Because I wasn't a Hall of Famer? This business isn't about what you did as a player. This business is about what you can do as far as analyzing the game of football, communicating it to other people so they can understand it and it makes sense to them, and giving them stuff that they didn't know. I know I can do that. I've proven I can do that. It's just a different platform. It's a huge, iconic brand. There's millions and millions of people watching. It's the only game on at that time. It has a long history with some people who have become legends in the broadcasting business. I get all that. I'm not worried about that in the least. I know I could nail that. I know I could knock it out of the park. And I look forward to having that opportunity to do so.
Lewis, when I'm not sure how often you got to hear him in a full game, but as sort of a football layman, I was really, really impressed with how Tony Romo in his first year came in and was prepared and explained the game. It just felt like in a different way to viewers than I had heard before. Are there some NFL game analysts that you think, whether at your network or other networks, that really do things the way you could see yourself doing them?
Yeah, what's interesting about Tony is Tony takes it next level. All right, he understands the game. He has a very good eye for what is coming or what he thinks is coming, and trying to tune some viewers into that. He has a very good eye for dissecting what has just happened, why certain things just happened, why teams try to employ certain strategies in certain situations, what teams will do to counteract those strategies. You know, I love those kinds of things about the game. Some people just don't like Tony because they don't like Tony. They don't like Tony because he played for the Dallas Cowboys. Some people don't like people who are smart, who try to take things next level. Some people just want things to be very surface and on the level. Hey, don't give me all that. Just let me watch the game. You just throw your comments in now. You're never going to please everyone. I personally happen to like how he does it. I'm a person who likes things going next level. I like next level analysis. Not to the point where you're trying to install a zone blitz defense and trying to get everybody to understand how the installation process would go. You don't have time for that anyway. But I like people who are trying to who help me see the game in a way that makes me smarter about the game. So when I'm watching a game and maybe they're not broadcasting it, I see certain things coming, or I understand why certain teams employ certain schemes, strategies, and tactics, and they just make me a better viewer of the game. Tony makes people a better viewer of the game. He just does. And so even if you're not listening to his broadcast, you start seeing certain things like going, hey, I remember when Romo was talking about that, and he said that these are the kind of things that teams do on offense on third down, and these are the kind of things defense do to counteract that thing on third down. Yeah, I mean, I love that. And I think that's the kind of thing that I look for and try to pick up on when people are talking about football, and the kind of thing that I hope that I would be able to bring to a live broadcast. And if you watch the Pro Bowl, there were things I was able to talk about from a schematic standpoint, from a bigger picture standpoint, from a front office standpoint. These are all the kind of things I think people would find fascinating when watching live games that I would be able to bring and that I look for other people to bring. And that's the kind of thing that holds my attention and I think would hold other people's attention.
All right, a couple more here, Lewis, and I appreciate the time. This has been really interesting to
me.
I'm always curious for the television analysts who do the draft like yourself, who are not Mel Kiper or McShay or Mike Mayock, who traffic in the draft every day, 365. Mm-hmm. So for you, tell me how do you prep for the potential sixth and seventh round picks where, you haven't seen Penn State, if you're looking at projecting where Barkley will go, you've obviously seen him a lot of times. He's on the highlights. You can watch him on national games. But the potential person in a sixth and seventh round, some kid from a Division III or Division II school who you may have never seen play on TV, how do you go about – what's your research process in terms of being able to talk about them with some intelligence on day three of the draft?
Yeah, you know what? Obviously, you take a very top-down approach to the draft. I mean, there's a lot of coverage for the first round, second round, third round. And that's where a lot of my prep goes into, because that's where most of our on-air time is really devoted to, really diving into those players. And look, I hit up all my contacts in the NFL who are in front offices. I have a tons of people who are now, who are on the road, who are finding out about these guys, talking to coaches, who I talk to all the time. And since that was my background anyway, I mean, they know that I know what they're talking about and the kind of things that they're doing to try to find out information. So I talk to those guys all the time. I talk to them all the time. Now, when you start talking about the prospects in the sixth, seventh round, guys who are a little bit more obscure, look, I beat the bushes and talked to my buddies, too. I said, look, who are the hottest guys who, relative to those types of players who are going to get drafted there, who are the hottest guys? Who are the people I need to be focusing on? So when those guys come up, you won't see me talk about every single guy, but I will pick certain players that I think I have very pertinent information on, and maybe information that other people don't have, that I will then jump in on and really try to talk about. There's no doubt that, look, Mel and Todd have an army of people who are working around the clock all year long to make sure that they cover those prospects in detail. I kind of approach it a little bit differently when we're talking about day three prospects. I try to be a little bit more targeted, have some general knowledge about most of the guys, but I will really try to zero in on certain specific guys that I know that people in the NFL who I trust implicitly are very high on, who are very excited about, who they think have some unique characteristics that people will want to hear about once it comes time to talk about them on TV. But as far as like the first three rounds, four rounds, I try to know just about everyone who's projected to go that high as far as character, background, how they would fit in the NFL, what teams would they most likely fit with, and then be very specific about what I think their strengths and weaknesses are. Again, the thing about me is that I've lived this life that the scouts are living right now. I know the kind of information they're just continually grinding to try to find. I've been out there. I've had my feet on the ground at some of these obscure colleges trying to find out anything and everything that could help us, meaning the team that I was working for, make a better decision. So I respect the hell out of this whole process. I know how much of a grind it is. And right now, my feet are on the ground grinding with them.
My final two questions for you, Lewis. If you were the Browns, if you're working in – I'm just fascinated by these two things. If you are in the Browns front office and you have the number one pick in the draft and the number four pick in the draft, then you obviously have needs all over the place, including quarterback. Do you like the prospect of gambling where you take Saquon Barkley with the number one pick and then, given the teams coming after you, including the Colts, likely – are not going to take a big-time quarterback, thinking at number four, you will get a quarterback. Maybe you don't get your first choice, but you're getting a quarterback that you like, or do you – because I know you know this from the NFL, the conventional wisdom is always don't let the player you want get off the board, so that's why you take, I guess, a quarterback at number one. But the Browns are in one of the most interesting situations we've seen in that they control the first four picks of the draft and potentially could land two franchise-type guys. How would you, if you were in that position, how would you approach that?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I've heard the people up there say they follow their board, and they follow their board 100%. And you're not going to tell me that any of the quarterbacks are going to be ranked higher than Saquon Barkley. It's just not going to happen. It's not going to organically happen that way, I don't think, for any team in the NFL right now. No one would say that. The only way that you would have a quarterback ranked over a guy like him is because you want it to look aesthetically the way you're going to actually carry it out on draft night. So when people walk into your draft room, when owners walk into your draft room and they bring their guests in there and they want to show off their draft board and all the things they're going to do, that guy who's sitting at the top of the board is going to be the guy who you're going to pick number one. And everyone says, well, yeah, that makes sense. You had him ranked right there. That's because, you know, because you're lying to yourself, but you want it to look the way it's going to pan out. And people do that. Trust me, they do that. They put people in position in order to justify where they're going to take them. That isn't necessarily the truth. Now, how would I do it? Would I be okay with taking the best player available, even if it wasn't a quarterback in that particular situation, and gambling on taking maybe the quarterback that I didn't have as number one on my board at number four? Well, the guy who I have at number one on my board at quarterback is not the same as maybe what most people are thinking is the guy who's going to be number one on most teams' boards. So if I'm Cleveland, yeah, I wouldn't have a problem taking Saquon Barkley and then at number four taking the quarterback that I want, because I think the quarterback that's number one for me is going to be sitting there at number four anyway. So I would be happier than a pig, and you know what? If I'm sitting there, I'd be perfectly fine with it. Now, it'll be interesting to see what the Browns do about it. We'll see if they artificially inflate one of these quarterbacks to number one on their board so they can pick a number one and then deal with the rest of the draft as it falls. But I don't know. I don't know what they're going to do. They say they're also open for business. I highly doubt that. They're going to pick somebody at number one. It's just whether or not they'll actually pick the best player in this draft or the player that they need the most in this draft, which there's no doubt that they need a quarterback. And that's why, as enviable of a position as it is to be in, meaning having all those draft picks that they have at their disposal, it's also one where I'm telling you, it's a little bit more difficult for them than I think than people realize about how to navigate those first four picks of the first round.
Yeah, I mean, you think that if they hit it, they could change their franchise's fortunes around. If they miss, I mean, it's a disaster for the next decade. They can't miss.
No question. No question.
The last one is I'm fascinated as to if you were a member of the New England Patriots management, how you would be looking at Tom Brady, in that the guy is still playing at a crazy level at his age. But, you have to understand, you have to acknowledge that his chronological age is what it is. So how would you, if you were in that position, sort of navigate playing Brady until whatever time Brady's not going to play anymore, and figuring out who the next quarterback is for that franchise? Belichick obviously is the best coach of all time, so I'm sure he has a plan. But it reminds me a lot of, because I live in New York, when Derek Jeter was nearing the end of his career, it was very tricky for the Yankees and their management to figure out how to play that in terms of, when do you as management start making the moves to figure out who the successor is, because the fact is the player has probably more leverage than management given the popularity. And that's what it feels like with Brady, in that there's no more popular athlete in New England. So I'm fascinated by that. Your top line thoughts on just what you think of all that.
Yeah, that's got to be a very, very tough position for Bill in particular, because here you're talking about a guy who was notorious for moving on from guys too early rather than too late, for always trying to stay out ahead of the curve, and that curve being the father time curve, to where he's not left holding the bag, so to speak, on a player who's hit the wall on him, and now he has no viable, suitable replacements. I can tell you with a significant amount of certainty that Bill didn't draft Jimmy Garoppolo to trade him to the San Francisco 49ers. They didn't draft him and select him in particular so that he could trade it to someone else, where now he's like the buzz of the league about how the 49ers may have knocked it out the park with that trade relative to the value that they got him for, in accordance with how he has looked so far in the short amount of time out there and what they expect him to play in the future. I'm sure that's killing Bill. It's killing him. He wanted to reap the benefits of that. He knows that at some point in time, Tom cannot continue to defy time like this. He just can't. And as much as, look, I love Tom Brady, I read everything I get my hands on about Tom Brady, because he is doing things that are unprecedented. But coaches and front office people know that they always have to anticipate the future to the best of their ability. And this can't continue. And I don't know what their plan is going to be going forward as far as how they look to get the heir apparent to Tom in there and have him ready to go so that transition is smooth. I don't know how they're going to do that. I don't know what their plan is, but, geez, I mean, Bill's always figured it out, but he had it right there. He had the heir apparent. He had drafted the perfect guy. He had drafted the perfect guy in Jimmy Garoppolo. I'm sure it's killing him that he's not on that team anymore, and it is a tricky thing, because you're right. Tom is an icon. Tom is the New England Patriots. Tom is the NFL in many ways. Tom is what people think about when you talk about championship high-level quarterback play. He's the standard. So how do you balance that? Whew. We need to get Bill on the phone. We need to get him on this podcast and ask him, even though he won't tell us. And I'm sure, look, Bill's a simple guy, too, for as complicated as he can seem. He's a simple guy too, and I'm sure he's sitting there too going, damn, how am I, what am I going to do about this? Because he had the answer, and he traded it away, which is a whole other story in and of itself.
Yeah, I think you're getting Belichick on the phone, Lewis, not me. But I appreciate the phone. Lewis Riddick is an NFL analyst for ESPN, where he appears on SportsCenter and NFL Live. He's going to be one of the main principals in the network's NFL draft coverage. If people who have obviously read my stuff at SI.com know what I think of Lewis Riddick, he, again, no hyperbole, he's one of the best hires ESPN has made, certainly in my lifetime, and I continue to enjoy his work. Lewis, thanks. This was really interesting. Thanks very much for coming back on the podcast, and I absolutely hope our paths cross again.
No question about it, Richard. I'm honored to be on your podcast. Look forward to listening to it.
All right, back to wrap up here, and we're on Skype today because I'm taping this from Toronto, so my thanks to Lou Pellegrino, my producer, for making this happen. Lewis Riddick is always a terrific interview, and it was no surprise once again that we got some really interesting stuff out of him. Previous podcasts include ESPN's Adnan Virk, the Big Ten Network's Dave Revson, Carrie Champion on Laurie Ingraham's comments on LeBron James and Kevin Durant, and then you could just basically go down the list of the Sports Illustrated Media podcast with Richard Deitch and check out previous episodes. If you like it, please leave a rating and a review. For Lou Pellegrino, for Sports Illustrated, for Cadence 13, this is Richard Deitch. We'll see you again on the Sports Illustrated Media podcast.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.